This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the audio space where, in 28 short minutes, you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, easing the lockdown. How? When? And what are the risks? This week, the Scottish Government published strategic guidelines for the conditions under which the lockdown could be eased. But in Europe, some countries have already started. The relaxations have been small, but the process has begun and seems to offer some hope. Today, I want to understand what the calculations are that are guiding those policies and what we in the UK have to learn from them. This side of the vaccine, is there a roadmap to recovery? Step inside the briefing room, and together we'll find out. Let's start with the virus itself. If we're to begin exiting lockdown, what do we need to know about COVID-19? What have we learned since the beginning of the pandemic? And what do we still not know that we need to? Dr. Natalie McDermott is an infectious disease specialist from Imperial College London. Natalie McDermott, when we did our first programme on this back in January, you were our first expert, and the scientific view then was that this virus would be most likely to seriously affect the old and the already unwell. Now, is that still broadly true?
Yes, I think that is still broadly true, but we are also seeing a number of cases in younger individuals and some who don't have underlying medical problems who are having a severe infection. We are still learning a lot about this virus.
Now, one of the things that's exercised people a great deal is the question of people walking around with the virus but being asymptomatic, just not having any signs that they've got it. Do we have any clear idea on what proportion of people who get the virus are asymptomatic?
So I think that that's something that we still need to determine. There have been a couple of small studies that we've seen the data from that suggest there could be high levels of asymptomatic infection within populations, anywhere up to 50 to 75%. That seems like a very high number, but it's not an impossibility. But we will only really determine that from a UK perspective, once we're able to do large-scale testing where we look for the actual virus at the back of the throat or testing for antibodies in due course.
Now, is there any reason to think that this virus is mutating significantly or that it weakens or strengthens over time?
So at the moment, it doesn't appear that there have been significant mutations in the virus. So it's not mutating at the same rate that we might expect in something like influenza.
Now, there was also some suggestion that when the warmer weather came, the virus would survive for less long than in colder weather. Is that being borne out?
We have seen significant spread of the virus in countries that have a much warmer climate than the UK. For instance, if we look at Singapore, while initially they did seem to contain the first outbreak there a bit better, over the last couple of days, they've had over 1,000 new cases a day. So that climate is far warmer than we ever reach. So I don't think we can assume that a warmer climate will necessarily change the situation with this virus. What it does change is we know that in the summer months, we don't have as many other infections presenting to hospital, and therefore we have a little bit more scope in terms of bed capacity.
What do we know about if we get it, our immunity to it thereafter?
I think a lot of the information we're taking on this at the moment has been essentially extrapolated from other coronaviruses and what we know of them rather than specifically SARS-CoV-2. We know that people generally mount an immune response following infection with a coronavirus and that they hold on to that, certainly for many months, but probably at least up to a year. But what happens after a year is unclear.
Now, this is really the $600 million question. What do we currently think we know about the percentage of people who have caught it in the population so far?
From a UK perspective, we know very little, I would say. I don't think we can suggest that there's high levels, even in London, yet, based on some of the data that's been presented from other populations, not UK populations. The rates of seropositivity, so those who have antibody to the virus, are lower than we might have expected.
So the vast majority of people, even in London, where it's been highest, have not had it and therefore almost certainly cannot be said to be immune.
Well, I think that that's the safe assumption to make, but really we will only know once we start testing people widely for antibodies.
Dr. Natalie McDermott. Now on to combating the virus and the key measurement used to discover how successful we are in doing it. If we need to understand any one thing in all this, it's R0. Dr. Michael Tilsley is an epidemiologist at the University of Warwick. Michael Tilsley, why is the R0 number so important?
This R0 that we talk about is the reproductive number. So when someone gets infected, it gives us an idea of, on average, how many people they might infect. So let's say the reproduction number is 2, then that means that every person that gets infected will infect, on average, 2 people. And of course, you can see if you follow this pattern very quickly, the total number of infected people builds up very, very rapidly. And this is what gives us an epidemic. Now, what we're trying to do when we introduce control policies is to reduce that reproduction number as low as possible. So if we can reduce that number to be below 1, then what that means is that for every person that gets infected, then on average, and I keep saying this because it is on average, they will infect less than 1 person. Then it means that eventually the epidemic will die out.
Now, what do we think the R0 number is currently in the UK?
This is an extremely hard question to put in a definitive answer on. We have pretty strong evidence to indicate that the reproduction number is currently below 1 because we're starting to see the number of daily hospitalizations go down. And there is evidence to suggest that fortunately the number of daily deaths is going down. What we don't really know yet is how far below 1 that might be. There is evidence to suggest it might be somewhere between, say, 0.6 and 0.9. And this is actually really important because if we think about lifting lockdown measures, it's really important for us to have an idea of how far below 1 we are. Because as we start to lift control, we will start to see that number rise. Now, if it turns out that R0 is, say, 0.5, then we've got quite a lot of leeway. If R happens to be close to 1, then that means that, unfortunately, when we start to lift some measures, we may see it going above 1 and we may start to see cases rise again.
How do you actually work out whether it's 0.9 or 0.6? Because that seems to me, from what you're saying, to make a very big difference.
Oh, well, it does. And now the problem that we have is, of course, we only have limited knowledge of who is infected in the population because we can't test everybody. So all we can do is we can look at the data that we've got and we could make inference regarding what we think R0 might be. But if we want really, really definitive answers on that, we need to be able to have much more information about how many people may be infected with only mild symptoms in the population.
Now, at the point where we had most infection in this country, obviously fairly recently, what did we estimate the R0 was then?
This is obviously an estimate, but estimates would suggest that R0 could have been anywhere between about 2 and 3, and some of the estimates may have put it slightly greater than 3.
Now, do we have any idea of what parts of the lockdown were most effective in reducing that from between 2 and 3 to between 0.6 and 0.9?
Now, this is actually a real challenge because one of the difficulties we have in trying to work this out is that when these lockdown measures were introduced, they were all introduced Over the space really of one weekend, by that Monday, we had obviously schools closing, we had pubs and restaurants closing, a lot of workplaces were closing. And then on the Monday evening, there was the announcement that we were going to go into total lockdown effectively. Now, that obviously presents us with a challenge because it's really difficult to untangle the relative effectiveness of all these different lockdown measures to work out what effect each of them have. And it may be that actually the only way we can really do that and get a real understanding of the relative effectiveness is when we start to relax procedures. And we may have to lift a certain measure, monitor what that does to the epidemic, and that will give us a much greater understanding of the effectiveness of those measures. I mean, certainly with the discussions I've had with people sort of not in academia, is the biggest challenge that people are facing is not necessarily lockdown, but the uncertainty regarding when that might end.
Dr. Michael Tildesley. So if you have your R0 in a good place, what can you do? Denmark is one of the countries that has begun the easing process. It was also one of the first in Europe to go into lockdown. The Briefing Room's Rosamund Jones spoke to Professor Hans Jørn Kolmos from the University of Southern Denmark.
We made our intervention at a rather early stage when we had had in the range of 25-30 deaths. It was imperative for us to slow down the epidemic to an extent where the Danish healthcare system could still cope.
In terms of the lockdown, what have you eased?
Well, right now, we have reopened schools, at least for the youngest five classes and kindergartens. And the reason why we started out there is that we need to get the parents back to their work, because otherwise parents would have to stay at home to take care of their small children. We have also opened the small businesses like hairdressing, for instance. Tattoos, those making the tattoos. Dentists have reopened.
Do consumers feel confident about going to their dentist, getting their haircuts?
Of course there is anxiety, but I think we all need a haircut because we have all got longer hair, and the hairdressers, they are pretty aware that they cannot book so many people as they used to do because you have to keep distance. So they book at a lower scale than usual. Of course, when you cut people's hair, you get in contact with them and you cannot avoid that. So it's a matter of good hand hygiene and trying to behave in a sensible way, and also to ask your customers, are you sure you're not ill, for instance, so that you don't transmit anything. The majority of Danes behave quite sensible. And the attitude is that if the government says it's okay now to reopen, for instance, for haircuts, then we go to our hairdressers again because we need to do that. And the reason why this is possible is that we kept the information level in the population at a very, very high level. So everybody is quite well informed on the situation.
Has Denmark kept its borders open?
Actually, we have closed our borders, in contrast to Sweden, which kept its borders open. Of course, we have a lot of export, so yeah, there's a lot of traffic out of the country, of commercial traffic. But ordinary people are not allowed to get in.
And so they're still currently closed?
Yes, yes. But I think we will also see reopening our borders, definitely.
There's this R0 number that people talk about a lot. What was Denmark's R0 number before it decided to ease the lockdown?
Well, I think it was in the range of 0.6. In our plans, we have stipulated that during the reopening process, it might increase to, let's say, 0.8. If it goes above, and particularly if it goes above 1, then we have a new epidemic situation, and then we have to get back to some of our more restrictive measures. So we really have to reopen in a controlled manner, monitoring the situation very carefully.
And how are you monitoring that situation?
We monitored with extensive testing. Of course, we are short of testing materials and facilities the same way as I think all countries in the world are. But gradually, we are managing to get testing facilities in place so that we can do testing on a larger scale. And of course, it is very important now to be able to test in all the situations where we may see minor flare-ups because of reopening, because I think we expect to see minor flare-ups of the epidemic. It's important to identify them very, very soon and to have a system where you unravel the transmission chains, identify all the people, get them tested, and get all the positive people in isolation.
So what do you think are the sectors that you will have most trouble with that you might open last?
I think restaurants and bars will get back to business, but they won't reopen 100%. We will reopen in a controlled manner with fewer guests in the same facilities for a long time. What we'd probably reopen as the last thing is that we'll probably not see football games with 30,000 coming into and sitting close to each other. I think that type of scenarios will reopen as some of the last ones.
So how long do you think this easing process, because it is a process, isn't it, is going to take? You've opened up a bit now. What are you going to do? Wait, see what happens, see what the numbers tell you, then make another decision, open something else, see what happens? Yeah. Is that the plan?
That's the plan. And I would say it would take at least half a year. And probably we also have to face a longer process. One of my worries as a medical doctor right now is that we have left the old and fragile people in the nursing homes. We have left them in complete isolation. And this is not a sustainable way of doing it in the long run. Imagine people in our nursing homes. Life expectancy for people in nursing homes is something like 2.5 or 3 years or something like that. And if they are going to be kept in complete isolation for 1 year from now, that would be a considerable part of the rest of their life. It's at least not human. It's a kind of prison.
Professor Hans-Jørn Kolmo stating plainly the impact of a lengthy easing on some vulnerable people. Different countries are doing different things. Now I want an overview of what they're up to and what, if I were a UK minister, I'd want to learn from them. Martin McKee is Professor of European Public Health at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. We know that in Europe people are easing in different ways. How would you describe those?
All of them are moving very tentatively indeed, doing one thing at a time and crucially monitoring the impact. They've all made clear that if cases start to rise, they will stop what they've done and perhaps reimpose the restrictions.
Now, let's look at the different things that some of them are doing, because they're actually opening slightly different things. And it's hard to work out on what different bases they're doing these.
Yes, it's a combination of politics and science. We have a lot of evidence of this from the United States, interestingly, because colleagues of mine at the University of Washington were able to show that states that have a Republican governor or where a majority of the population voted for Donald Trump in the presidential election delayed imposing restrictions on average by several days compared to those where the Democrats are in charge. The United States will be providing us with a remarkable natural experiment.
Now, as we look at what people have done, are we beginning to see any kind of common approaches emerge and any kind of common lessons emerge? I mean, in the first instance, let's take one that's confusing me a great deal at the moment. Is there any common view about the wearing of masks?
I think we're seeing a common view emerging, but nobody, I think, is suggesting that we should be wearing surgical masks, at least I hope not. We're talking about face coverings made of cloth that can be washed and reused. And we are seeing these being implemented in Germany, in Austria, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Morocco. There's a number of reasons why many people, including myself, have changed our mind. First, we've realized that much of what we thought we knew relates to influenza. But there's new research coming out of Hong Kong University showing that even a tea towel, any cloth covering, can significantly reduce the spread of coronaviruses. And one of the reasons for this is that, unlike a number of other respiratory diseases that are spread by coughing from people who are already showing symptoms, coronaviruses are spread by ordinary talking, often before people develop symptoms.
What about school openings? Do we have any kind of common view emerging about whether schools, kindergartens, which have been opened in Denmark, should be opening or not?
I think it will be important to evaluate what happens in countries like Denmark that are doing it, because a lot of the work has been based on modelling. And as we've seen, all models, as one eminent statistician once said, all models are wrong, but some are useful. So we'll have to wait and see.
As far as you can see, are countries actually talking to each other and learning from each other's experiences?
Countries within the European Union are very much learning from each other. Ministers and the senior officials are talking on a daily basis, as are the public health authorities. The problem comes with the United Kingdom. And of course, the UK is now in effect socially distancing from the rest of Europe. Now, in the research community among academics like myself, we're talking to our colleagues on a daily basis and getting a wealth of information from that. But I do know that that isn't always being fed through into the authorities in the UK.
One of the things that seems to be very different from one European country to another is actually levels of testing and therefore of possible contact tracing. And we're pretty low down on the testing side. What difference is that making between the countries that are doing significant testing and their capacity to ease and countries that have not done significant testing like Britain and their capacity to ease?
I think what we've heard in the Downing Street briefings over the last few days has been a clear indication that we do need to ramp up the testing before we actually do ease up in any way. It's very clear that more could have been done to bring together everybody who can test in the United Kingdom. And it was very surprising that it took so long to involve the veterinary laboratories who are testing for viruses all the time, and also the private laboratories. Obviously, we don't know why we got this so badly wrong, but until we get it right, it will make it much more difficult.
Does that mean that when we start our easing, our basis for doing it will be riskier than, say, Germany's or Denmark's, where they've done significant testing?
I think that's probably true. And I suspect that those who are making the decisions are well aware of that. We have an awful lot of catching up to do.
Within the period before the vaccine, when do you think we will be able to approach anything like resembling normal life?
I really don't know. There are so many unknowns here. And I think in particular, one of the concerns is not going to be what anybody does in their own country, what a government does, but what happens in the rest of the world. And here we are looking at the challenges of this virus getting into some very fragile societies elsewhere. And also, we really have to look at the United States.
Are you saying that actually it presents a current danger of reinfection to the rest of the world?
It definitely does. And this is something that at some point the rest of the world's governments are going to have to do something about.
Professor Martin McKee. And this week it was announced that 20,000 English households were being contacted to take part in a study involving regular testing to track coronavirus in the general population. So now let's push this into the near future. Pretty soon, government, business and services are going to need a plan for the pre-vaccine world of an eased lockdown, but in conditions which keep R0 below 1. What will we have to change to manage this new existence? Nairi Woods is Professor of Global Economic Governance at Oxford University. Nairi Woods, most of us haven't had the disease, so we'll be living with the risk of secondary outbreaks for some time to come. Now, what are the things that you think we'll need to do to get us to a semblance of normality within that pre-vaccine period?
We've got to get testing, tracing and isolating up and running fantastically well. We've got to shield the high vulnerability settings, the care homes and such like. We've got to start thinking about what kind of preventative measures can be put in public places and in schools. We've got to manage the import of cases. So really think about what our travel restrictions are. That's a clear checklist in order safely to start easing the lockdown.
Right. Let's talk about what some of those things mean when you dig right down into them. Will we still need to, say, quarantine those who continue to arrive from other countries?
You either are going to have a reliable way to test them to know whether they're infected, or you're going to have to quarantine them. So what China is doing is requiring every person coming into China to do a 14-day mandatory quarantine in a government quarantine facility. This is the lesson from countries that have done quite well. I mean, all of China's new cases have been a re-import of the virus with Chinese nationals coming home from abroad. You know, this is a global pandemic. And until it's under control in other places, we're going to have to control our borders.
Okay, well, let's talk about what businesses and organisations would have to do in this country. Because I imagine that in the period we're talking about, those places that can function will be those places that can create a certain degree of social distancing. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that's right. You can reduce the density of people on transport by staggering the different times that people travel. And the other idea that's in circulation is thinking about age segmentation. You know, do we let everybody under 40 move back into, for example, education institutions and such like, and then give provision for those in more vulnerable brackets to either go in person or to go virtually into those spaces to teach or to learn or to interact and to work?
You've just raised so many hairs there that they're really interesting. Are you saying that if, say, you have a teacher who's 60, that teacher should be allowed to virtually teach, whereas, let's say, a teacher under 40 who's considerably less at risk, you might expect to turn up at school?
Those are the questions we've got to ask. These aren't insurmountable problems. We do just have to think through, can we make this work, and that we preserve some capacity for people to self-protect. So if you've got a teacher under 40 with vulnerable conditions, that they can take measures to protect themselves. Yes, we are going to have to think these things through, because the alternative is to stay in a total lockdown.
Let's say business is already operating on a small margin. This is going to be really difficult, isn't it, to actually implement measures within the finances they have available?
It is. And, you know, we've got to really be careful here that economically we don't end up with an economy which only has a small number of enormous businesses. We need an economy with lots of small, thriving businesses. Small businesses tend to have far less cash and therefore are much more vulnerable to going out of business quickly.
Can we talk about the trade-off that you've alluded to there and take it on a little bit? Do you think in the end, as we go through this long period before the vaccine, decisions will begin to be taken for political, economic and social reasons and not for public health reasons?
Where you see the real element of that debate is in a place like Nigeria, where very quickly after the lockdown, most of the population were saying, look, I have 100% certainty of dying from hunger if I stay in my slum. I've got only a 10% likelihood of dying from COVID. I'm going to take my chances and go out and get some food. And we do have to recall that that's the stark reality for a lot of people in the world, and even for people in Britain, that this is pushing to the brink. But it's not just the lockdown that will impede the economy. When people are fearful and scared, they won't come out and go out to dinner. Japan has no law forbidding people from going to restaurants. But talking to colleagues in Tokyo yesterday, they were telling me the restaurants are empty. People are afraid. And that's why we need governments to take actions which reassure people that they can go about certain kinds of business, even if it means in a completely new way and a different way and a more limited way, and that they're willing to do that.
Professor Nairi Woods. So what conclusions might we draw from this? Well, I draw two. This huge problem can't be solved ideologically, and it can't be solved by ourselves alone. We need to be open to the experience of other countries, and we need to be anxious to learn. My thanks to Natalie McDermott, Michael Tilsley, Hans-Jürgen Kolmos, Martin McKee and Nairi Woods. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Darren Graham and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by Never Miss Syrian and the editor was Jasper Corbett. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. And if you enjoyed it, you may find other episodes interesting, including the inequalities of lockdown, the psychological impact of the pandemic and coronavirus, from testing to vaccine. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.